Welcome to a special episode of the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and this week we're going to be hearing from Sarah Laverty, who is the host of the Science of Getting Faster podcast, one of the other podcasts we do here at Trainer Road. If you haven't listened to it, you're missing out. It's where we interview researchers about a specific study on a topic that relates to you and how you can get faster as a cyclist. So Sarah's going to walk you through just like some teasers and some recaps of recent episodes. Then you know what to expect. And then of course, down in the description, you'll be able to click right there. There's a link that you'll see to go to the Science of Getting Faster podcast and subscribe. You can also search for it on any podcast app that you use, and you can subscribe there and make sure you don't miss a single episode, as they will make you faster. They're fantastic listens. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Sarah. I hope you enjoy this special episode.
We'll start with episode 5, where we discuss Dr. Tim Podlegar's study, which investigated the long-held belief that carb intake above 90 grams per hour was not beneficial to performance. Dr. Podlegar first explained how we use different substrates, why we're interested in maximizing our carbohydrate availability, and how we might do so. Are there then specific intensities that we utilize our carbohydrate stores more than, say, proteins and fats? Do we use these different fuel sources at different intensities?
So usually we just, when we talk about endurance exercise, we assume protein oxidation to be negligible, so like pretty much zero. There is a very small, a tiny proportion of protein being used for exercise, for the energy, but the proportion is very small, as I said. It actually increases if carbohydrate availability is insufficient. So you actually start to use more protein if you are low on glycogen or not ingesting enough carbohydrates. Because this is pretty much like a power saving mode. You kind of start breaking down the muscle because simply there is not enough glucose floating around the body. And this is one of the points why we actually want to increase carbohydrate availability and eat carbohydrates during exercise and not protein, because it doesn't really make sense. The first thing I really wanted with this study was, because we cannot actually quantify accurately exogenous carbohydrate and fat oxidation rates at really high intensities. So the consequence of this was, let's find highly trained individuals that can produce a lot of power and are still below the first ventilatory threshold, so that we can accurately actually measure carbohydrate and fat oxidation rates. And in this way, we create the demand for energy, really high demand for energy, and expose them to either 90 or 120 grams per hour. So here things become more complicated, even more complicated, because we introduce a different ratio between glucose-based carbohydrates, which is maltodextrin, and fructose. The reason being that if we look back into the old studies, we will probably usually be seeing the fructose to glucose ratio as 1 to 2. So one fructose molecule for each one fructose for each two glucose molecules, so 2 to 1 or 1 to 2 ratio. I keep using different orders, so I'm a bit confused now. And this ratio has actually been created based on the previous findings that there is a limitation to oxidize glucose-based carbohydrates, which is 60 grams per hour. So if you want to go higher than this, we need to add fructose. So they just simply added half of this amount and got to 90 grams per hour. 60 plus 30 is 90, and it's 2 to 1 ratio. Very simple. And for ages, and this ratio was like the only ratio out there, and everybody was using it, and this was like 90 grams per hour was a gold standard. But then later on, researchers tried to find the optimal ratio in terms of how people, how effectively or efficiently people oxidize carbohydrates that are ingested, how their gut feels, so whether they're experiencing gastrointestinal discomfort or not, and what this means on the performance later on. And then they discovered that perhaps this 2 to 1 ratio is not optimal, and that perhaps we should be more closer to the unit, so more closer to 1-to-1 ratio. And this is where this 1-to-0.8 ratio is coming from. So one glucose, 0.8 of fructose.
What makes those two different types of carbohydrates? What makes them different?
So yeah, this can be really complex. So the most obvious and the most like prevalent explanation why we see improved oxidation when we add fructose is that these two carbohydrate types are being transported differently from the intestines into the bloodstream. So we have different types of transporters. So if you think about the transport only, when you saturate the glucose transporters, you can still utilize the fructose transporters. And this way, you can get more carbohydrates into the body.
Next, we looked at how we utilize carbohydrates over the course of long-duration exercise. They were exercising then for 3 hours. Why did you choose 3 hours? Why were you so mean?
Because all my studies are like this. So usually when people are looking at exogenous carbohydrate oxidation rates, they're looking at or investigating them for like 2 to 3 hours. And the reason being that when we assess the 13C enrichment of the breath, CO2, we see a gradual increase, and only like an hour and a half to 2 hours into the trial, we see a plateau. And this plateau then resembles the highest oxidation rates. So this is why I really wanted to make sure that exogenous carbohydrate oxidation rates, that we are actually able to pick the highest rates possible. And also one of the things why we also see this like gradual increase is probably down to the fact that muscle at the start of exercise has quite a lot of muscle glycogen. So it uses that glycogen very effectively and doesn't bother about the glucose. But over time, when the glycogen concentrations decline in the muscle, it starts to uptake more and more glucose from the bloodstream. And this is why you probably see this rise and then a plateau in exogenous carbohydrate oxidation rates.
Great. And how then did you give them the carbohydrate? Was it through frequent intervals throughout those 3 hours, or was there a specific protocol that you were following?
So, yeah, this is kind of a really good question because when we, in our lab in Birmingham, there is a tradition like of these kind of studies, and we always give them a big bolus at the start. So, like, it's not regular intervals of, like, I don't know, 45 grams every half an hour for 90 grams condition, or 40 grams every 20 minutes, whatever. But we give them a big bolus at the start. And the idea is that we saturate the transporters as soon as possible so that we kind of fill up the intestine, as quickly as possible. And then we can actually see, the oxidation rates, it's very like mechanistic, let's say, the study in terms of like we want to assess oxidation rates. And this is why we do this in this way.
Finally, Dr. Podlagar shared what he observed in the study, ultimately giving us a new perspective on recommendations for fueling during exercise.
First thing that we found out was obviously exogenous carbohydrate oxidation rates are higher with 120 as compared to 90 grams per hour. So we can oxidize more carbohydrates if we eat more, which kind of, yeah, makes sense. So the peak oxidation rates were on average around 1.5 grams per minute with 120 grams per hour. So meaning that 90 grams of carbohydrates were oxidized, whereas 30 grams were either still in the intestines or stored somewhere in the body, which would actually make sense given the really high amounts being eaten. And perhaps you can see like a small spike in insulin, and then you see some of the carbohydrates going into the arms, and yeah, they're just stored as glycogen there. But overall, 120 was from this aspect better. The funny and the most interesting thing was that this did not translate into sparring of endogenous carbohydrate oxidation rates. In other words, the reason why we thought 120 would be beneficial is that this would then require body to use less glycogen, but it did not. So the glycogen utilization was exactly the same. The most important thing when it comes to nutrition for endurance athletes is to maximize carbohydrate availability, especially for high intensity training sessions. So this means that if you have like I consider high intensity everything that's above this threshold that we've talked about. So all the sweet spot threshold for VO2max work, that's high intensity for me. And for those sessions, you definitely want high glycogen concentrations before each and every of those sessions. So meaning eating a lot of carbohydrates. And by doing this, you will expose the body to a lot of carbohydrates. And if a person is training day after day, is fit, is over time not gaining weight, I don't see a problem in eating large amounts of carbohydrates. I think there is no negative impact on health from this regard, because I know that people are concerned about this, but there is actually, I mean, very little or no evidence to indicate that high carbohydrate diets, even like consisting of sugars, when you're in caloric balance, can actually harm your health if you are active. I think that exercise prevents this. So this is rule number one. And then the next one is, yeah, well, you want the carbohydrates. You want to eat the carbohydrates during exercise because this way you kind of add a boost to the exercise and also like build the tolerance because you probably are preparing yourself for really long rides, like 4 or 5 hours, where you will be facing glycogen depletion on one hand, and you also need a tolerance to actually be able to tolerate this large amount of carbohydrates in the gut, especially like in the hot summer days, which are more and more prevalent, I guess, because of global warming. We know that in the heat, those problems can be very problematic because the blood is being distributed, like taken away from the intestines towards the skin and the muscle, and we get more problems. And with this building the tolerance, we actually probably can improve this situation. So I think this is kind of super important. In terms of the quantities, it's really hard to say. So for training the gut, yes, high amounts are necessary. I would, yeah, if the aim is to train the gut, I would go with 90 to 120 grams per hour for certain sessions, but too much of carbohydrates, I mean, this amount of carbohydrates during every single session, perhaps is not the best idea. Although there is some evidence, actually, that really high amounts of carbohydrates during exercise can improve the recovery. And this is kind of interesting thing. And the reason probably why this happens is that carbohydrates simply don't get absorbed during exercise, but they get absorbed straight after the exercise. So basically, you have already eaten your recovery meal. So when you have a shower and clean your bike and have the first meal, in this time, you actually have already initiated the recovery process. Whereas if you were eating like very small amounts of carbohydrates, you would still be in the catabolism phase and be still breaking down the muscle pretty much.
But there's much more in the full episode that will help you get faster, including the following topics. Can some people utilize higher amounts of carbohydrate more than others? And what does that depend on? What do the pros do? Is there benefit to consuming more carbohydrate if we aren't sparing glycogen? And how can we train our gut to improve our tolerance and ability to absorb carbohydrates? Next, we spoke with Dr. Brian Saunders about whether caffeine affects habitual consumers differently than occasional consumers. Dr. Saunders first covered the basics. How much caffeine should athletes ingest? We're talking about caffeine and whether habitually consuming it impacts ergogenic effects. Historically, how has caffeine been used as a performance-enhancing agent?
So historically, caffeine's been around in sports for a long time. If you look at sort of the Tour de France, actually, the sort of videos of in the early 1900s of these cyclists jumping off their bikes, running into cafes, downing a few espressos, alongside a fair few other sort of products that would definitely be banned today. And since then, it's kind of gone from strength to strength, really. That being said, you know, it was kind of sort of banned in competition for a while. There was sort of a threshold amount in urine that above which you would test positive. So that was about 12 micrograms per milliliter. But this actually kind of is quite a lot of caffeine. And back in 2004, caffeine was actually taken back off this anti-doping list. So, you know, the last few years, certainly research has really grown. And from my experience, its use in competition and training has really grown as well.
If we were to quantify that in terms of cups of coffee, how much would we have to drink to get to that limit?
It's quite a high limit.
Okay.
So it's quite difficult to define in one way because there's so much variation in the quantity of caffeine that you get in your cup of coffee. You know, the source of the coffee, the way you prepare it, and even the day to day, you know, you could put your three or four scoops in, but one day to the next, there'll still be a different amount of caffeine in your cup of coffee. That being said, you know, you could probably say something along the lines of maybe 6 to 8 cups of coffee, potentially more. You know, there's studies that have shown that if you actually provide the caffeine, around 5 to 6 milligrams per kilogram of body mass, which is quite a fairly reasonable dose, wouldn't get you to that limit. So, yeah, the threshold's quite high, potentially variable, but you're probably around 6 to 8 cups of coffee, so quite a lot.
What did you find with regard to the dose? Do you have to consume a certain amount, or does it need to be comparable to your routine caffeine consumption?
So those were two things that we try to dig a little into. So in the literature, generally, the recommendations are 3 to 6 milligrams per kilogram of body mass. So we generally provide in studies doses relative to the individual. And so we kind of separated out those studies that had less than 3 milligrams per kilo, 3 to 6 and above 6. And when looking at that kind of lower than 3 milligrams per kilo and 3 to 6, the performance benefits were there, and they seem sort of comparable between the two. However, above 6 milligrams per kilo, it seemed like we showed no significant benefit on exercise performance. A caveat on that is that there were very few studies with the higher doses, but you know, this is what other studies have shown as well, that higher doses of caffeine, although some individual studies show benefits, a lot don't, and a lot show potentially greater side effects with caffeine. You know, you might get greater headaches, nausea, jitters, all these kinds of negative side effects that you see when you get to the higher end of the caffeine scale. So certainly, our data support kind of 3 to 6 milligrams per kilo, and potentially suggest that less is also good, is also beneficial to performance.
We then discussed the commonly overlooked question of how caffeine actually improves performance and dispelled a couple of common misconceptions along the way. Physiologically, how does caffeine improve performance, or how is it speculated to improve performance?
So that's, you know, a question that I think research has been trying to get to the bottom of for the last 50 odd years, probably now. One of the initial mechanisms sort of that people suggested was that it could increase fat burning. That's due to sort of an increase in adrenaline that is produced due to the ingested caffeine. This sort of increased sort of oxidation of fats would then spare your muscle glycogen, and then you could sort of perform exercise for longer. You know, what we do see during exercise, increased fat oxidation commonly occur in lots of different studies. But I think sort of overall over the last 20 years, that theory's maybe sort of been drowned out a little bit. You know, there's that mechanism can't explain, for example, how kind of short duration, high intensity exercise is improved with caffeine. So right. If it isn't, you know, a mechanism, it's definitely not the only one.
And then, so assuming that caffeine, at least from an anecdotal perspective, it feels like you can run, like your adrenaline is going, so you have, it's like you're in fight or flight to run faster. And assuming then that the intensity is increasing, would that then offset the effects of increased fat burning if you're increasing the intensity due to that adrenaline rush? Because assuming that the exercise intensity is modulating what substrate we're using.
It's a good point, I guess. Again, that's more relevant for the shorter duration, high intensity exercise when you're looking at the really endurance stuff. We might see a slight increase in power output, a slight increase in intensity, but you're probably not jumping from, you know, 75% of your maximum to 90% of your maximum either. You know, all supplements generally have a kind of a fairly moderate effect on these outcomes.
Okay.
But then just touching on that, I think that's an important point about sort of, maybe cut that out and I'll let you sort of jump back to a question.
Yeah, no worries. So does it have then an impact on our central nervous system? Is there theories behind that?
Yeah, so that's the primary mechanism by which we believe that caffeine works. So via the antagonism of adenosine receptors within the central nervous system. And so these adenosine receptors, they're responsible for motor function, the reward systems, behavior, and they work in collaboration with the dopamine receptors, so sort of the reward center. So the chemical structure of caffeine is similar to adenosine, so that allows it to bind to these receptors. And now, you know, usually when adenosine binds, what we see is a reduction in kind of behavioral activation, volition. You know, high concentrations of adenosine are related to sleep. So if this binding is then inhibited, what we have is a higher activation also of the dopamine receptors. We see increase of dopamine, norepinephrine, or adrenaline, noradrenaline. We see an increase in central motor drive, reduced perception of effort during exercise. And also this can even sort of peripherally alter sort of the muscular response. So, you know, via sort of a number of different mechanisms, even sort of pain mechanisms as well, we see a reduced perception of pain during exercise as well. So all these kind of bind together to what we think is lead to the improvements in exercise performance.
So what exactly was Dr. Saunders investigating with this study? What was the question then that you were trying to answer in this paper? Can you remind us?
One of the things that's come sort of to my attention, but also to the attention of a lot of researchers recently, is that across a lot of caffeine studies, there does seem to be some variability in the response to supplementation. What we see is generally up to as much as kind of 35% of people don't seem to respond or respond to a lesser extent. And I guess the question is why? And so there's a lot of potential theories, why genetics is one of them. But certainly more recently, interest has gained traction in the importance of habitual caffeine consumption on this response. So many people suggest that habitual caffeine consumption may generate a tolerance to its effects. So then this will reduce its potential benefits. And so that's why some people might not have a benefit, because they are caffeine consumers on a daily basis. And so because they've built up a tolerance over time, then they do a benefit when supplementing it prior to an exercise bout. You know, we did a bit of research on the topic before forming this meta-analysis. And despite, you know, people, I think anecdotal evidence of, oh yeah, I don't feel the effects of caffeine anymore. You know, you always hear people say these kinds of things. Despite that, you know, I wasn't too convinced that it had an effect, because I've used caffeine myself and seen an effect. And I think I take, you know, fairly large amounts per day, but obviously, you know, an NF1 in uncontrolled conditions isn't the greatest study. So we performed a study to look at, do people with sort of high, moderate and low caffeine consumption, you know, do they benefit from caffeine supplementation similarly? And they did. They all did. So coming into this, I kind of had a hunch that these data wouldn't necessarily show anything different. I can't give you a particularly scientific reason for that. But sort of based upon our own previous data, I just felt like we'd probably show something similar.
And what did Dr. Saunders discover after this meta-analysis was complete? So what did you find? Did you find that we can have our coffee and drink it? Or?
Well, I hope the title does suggest that, but yes. The main finding from our meta-analysis is that caffeine works. Caffeine improves exercise performance. It's a small but significant effect. I think, as I said earlier, I think most supplements generally just have a small effect on performance, but that can make the difference. But most importantly here is that the size of this effect was not influenced by habitual caffeine consumption of the individual. So, you know, caffeine was effective regardless of, you know, whether the individuals were high caffeine consumers, moderate caffeine consumers, low or naive. So I think in general, a win for the coffee drinkers, for the tea drinkers, for the caffeine drinkers.
Other topics covered in this episode that will help you get faster include how exercise intensity affects caffeine, how you can tell how much caffeine you're actually consuming, how much caffeine should athletes consume? Do the negative effects of caffeine negate the positive effects? And how does caffeine affect training adaptations? Why does caffeine seem to affect people differently? And how to time caffeine with training and racing? What's next for the Science of Getting Faster podcast? A long overdue scientific look into how beetroot supplementation affects athletic performance with Dr. Stephen Bailey. Dr. Bailey offers clarity around the differences between nitrates, nitrites, and nitric oxide, how they impact our physiology, and what conditions might enhance this effect.
There's two forms of nitrates. There's the organic nitrates that are synthetic compounds that are used to treat cardiovascular diseases. And we're not going to talk about them in today's podcast. Instead, what we're going to focus on is the form of nitrate that's abundant in foods. So we have nitrate that's present in certain foods, particularly green leafy vegetables and beetroot. So nitrates are produced in these particular plants. And then they are obviously consumed by us as humans. And over the last few years, it's been emerged that if you consume these as part of a healthy, balanced diet, then you can start to see some beneficial effects on various aspects of physiology and also some aspects of exercise performance as well. It is believed that nitrate is relatively biologically inert. We can't rule out for sure that they don't have any physiological role, but it is largely believed that after consuming nitrate, it's not the nitrate per se that has the effect, but it's the subsequent reduction, the chemical reduction of nitrate down into nitrite, and then more likely the subsequent reduction of nitrite down into nitric oxide and other reactive nitrogen intermediates. This is believed to bring about the positive effects of dietary nitrate supplementation. Well, nitric oxide is a multifaceted physiological signaling molecule, so it can impact quite an array of physiological processes. So as some examples that might be most relevant in an exercise context, the classical way that NO has been brought to bring about physiological effects is to serve as a relaxer of the smooth muscle cells in the blood vessels. And this can bring about vasodilation, which is where we open up the blood vessels and can deliver more blood and therefore oxygen and other nutrients down to the tissue. And that might also have a role for causing the removal of potential byproducts from the tissue. It's also got clear metabolic effects. So nitric oxide is recognized to have a role in, for example, glucose uptake into muscle tissue. It's recognized to have effects on the mitochondria. So these are the powerhouses of the cell, which are responsible for resynthesizing ATP, which is our main source of energy for performing muscular contractions. They also have, nitric oxide also has quite an effect on muscle contractile processes themselves. So it can influence the release of calcium into the cytosol, which is a key event that brings about muscle contraction. It can also impact the muscle contractile apparatus themselves, so actin and myosin. So, and there's obviously various other processes, neurotransmission, but that just hopefully gives you a little bit of flavor. But NO is involved in a myriad of physiological processes. Yeah, absolutely. So what we seem to know about the metabolic pathway and specifically the reduction of nitrite down into nitric oxide is this reaction needs a proton. So therefore, it's favored in conditions of acidosis. We also know that obviously acidosis is more likely to develop in conditions of lower oxygen tensions. So what we know is that the reduction of nitrite into nitric oxide seems to be enhanced in conditions of lower pH or acidosis and conditions of lower oxygen content within blood vessels and within tissues. So those seem to be the conditions that are quite effective at stimulating the reduction of nitrite into nitric oxide. And that's also quite useful from an exercise perspective, because we know that in the muscle tissues and in the microvasculature, the little blood vessels that surround the muscle, we know that particularly doing higher intensities of exercise, then pH will decline and the oxygen tension will also decline. So that gives us a ripe environment, if you like, for the nitrite to be reduced down into nitric oxide.
We also discussed the exciting potential of nitrates to improve endurance performance.
Generally speaking, nitrate supplementation, if we're dealing with young, healthy individuals and it's being given at a sufficient dose, has the potential to lower the oxygen cost of low-intensity exercise. So I'm talking about exercise below the lactate threshold. So this is typically the intensity that most people would run a marathon at, for example. So quite low-intensity exercise that can be sustained for several hours. The literature does seem to suggest, it's not observed in all studies, but in the meta-analyses that have been published, there is evidence to suggest that nitrate supplementation overall can lower the oxygen cost of exercise. Again, at least in recreationally active individuals. This effect seems to be lost as you go to better trained individuals.
Listening to the upcoming Science of Getting Faster podcast to find out if nitrates do in fact improve performance in well-trained athletes. Under what conditions are we most likely to experience performance-enhancing effects? If and why there might be differences between athletes racing in different disciplines and of varying fitness levels? What determines our likelihood of seeing a beneficial effect of nitrate supplementation? And the volume of nitrates required to see an ergogenic effect? And how long before our event should we consume nitrates? All of that, plus the previous episodes, can be found on your favourite podcast app by tapping the link in the description for this podcast episode, or by searching Science of Getting Faster in your preferred podcast app. Hit subscribe so that you don't miss the many more coming your way. Have a lovely day.